Calling all lovers of mystery and fans of a good story. If you haven't already heard me talk about June's journey, you're in for a treat. It's time to don your detective hat in this free hidden object mobile game that delves into the captivating journey of June Parker, a self-proclaimed detective on a quest to unravel the mystery surrounding her sister's untimely death. In June's journey, you get to play as June, deciphering clues and unveiling secret plots within thousands of beautifully illustrated scenes. And did I mention it's set in the glitzy 1920s? New chapters are added weekly, so you will never run out of new thrills to uncover, and you can also personalize and decorate your very own Orchid Island where the story takes place. How sharp are your detective skills? Find out when you download June's Journey on your Android or iOS device, or play online via Facebook Games. Your detective journey awaits.
Hello, I'm Alison Larkin, writer, comedian, narrator, and host of the Jane Austen podcast. Join me as we embark on a journey through Austen's timeless stories, starting with Pride and Prejudice. The Jane Austen podcast with Alison Larkin is available wherever you listen to podcasts.
I have got so much respect for the sea now. I mean, it's a changing environment all the time. I mean, I have so much respect for it. I thought if I ever get fall into the sea by myself, I'll be fine. I'd say the sea is so unpredictable. Mm. You know, please, anyone listening, respect the sea. It is such a dangerous thing.
Graham Souness there, telling you why you really should be respecting the sea after he swam the channel for charity. Good on him. Ever going to swim the channel, Dale?
Who knows? One day, maybe.
Oh, it seems a lot of work, doesn't it? It seems a lot of effort.
Yeah, but the reward. Imagine being able to like be a person that can say, I've swam the channel.
Have you swam the channel, Matt?
No, I've got... I'm not as fearful of deep sea creatures as Emma is, but my respect for the sea does predominantly come from my fear of it.
Okay. Fair enough. That's wise. I go swimming all the time. When's the last time you went to a swimming pool?
About
people go to 4 swimming pools
ago.
Anymore? Really?
Yeah. We got a Lido in Reading that I went to. It was nice. Hot day for it.
That does sound lovely. All the weather's been warm, but let's not linger on that because it's dull. This is the IGN UK podcast where we're going to talk about all sorts of things this week. We've got a little bit of Secret Invasion talk going on. Not a lot, but a bit because... Mainly, all this week, we've been playing Final Fantasy 16. And for you two lads, you've been playing it for a couple of weeks. I've nearly finished Final Fantasy 16. I'm right near the end. You two have finished it, though. And I think we have some mixed thoughts on the game. It's been getting universal acclaim. And I think I'm at the more positive end of our spectrum. Not that you two guys don't like it. I should say that you both think it's a good game.
Mm-hmm. It's flawed,
I think I'm
though.
Slightly higher on it. Than you guys. Let's start about what we like about Final Fantasy 16, which there is quite a lot to like, I think. Namely, I think we've got to start with the combat, because we've talked about the combat before when we've done previews. Both me and you, Matt, have done previews of this game, and the combat's always been the standout thing. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that really lets itself down in the full game either. It takes a while, I think, to get to where I thought it would.
Yeah,
but now I'm near the end game. I think like this combat. I literally can't stop playing because I just want to enjoy this combat so much.
Yeah, I think one of the things that kind of like when I did the preview back in February, I think it was for combat purposes, they put me in what for any of you guys that have actually already started playing Final Fantasy, the section that comes like after the demo effectively is where mm-hmm. I played, but I'd got a full suite of icon abilities for that demo. And so I was seeing it at its full potential, and it takes a lot longer in the main game to get to the point where you have three icons that Clive has access to. And obviously it's only when you get three icons that each have their own unique powers that you get to the point where you can learn how to juggle between each one of those three and use each of their unique abilities and find out where kind of like you can create interesting chains. Mm-hmm. And it takes quite a while to get to that point. I was surprised at how slow it is to deliver those. And then you almost go through a flurry where you get a few quite quickly, mm-hmm. and then it makes you wait to get like the last couple. But when it is at full potential and it's in the right combat encounters, I think the combat is very, very strong and very enjoyable. It's maybe not as deep as what a turn-based combat could be, and it's not as deep as a full action game could be, but I think it kind of hits like an interesting sweet spot. I quite like that.
I love it.
I think there's like, I definitely agree with you. I think it's not as deep as I wanted it to be. However, I would say the variety in moves is like fantastic.
Yeah.
And the game does two amazing things that really encourage you to experiment and try new combinations, which is one, that it can at any point let you reset your points, not just overall, but also for individual things. Mm-hmm. So you can say, oh, I've tried this ability, I actually don't like this one and I want to try this one. I can
just refund
those points and put it over here. I swap things around so many times.
Yeah, me too.
And another amazing thing, you can only load two abilities per icon. However, once you master an ability, you can then switch them around onto other icons. And I thought that was really nice, because there were several abilities where I felt like, oh, the Ifrit ability and the Garuda ability would work really well, complement really well together. And instead of having to swap through on the fly, I could now put them on the same compartment. Mm-hmm.
I've got a perfect combo for this, Leah. I've used one of the Garuda abilities, which sends people up in the air, and then I use another ability, which I'm not going to reveal like all the icons yet, because it might be spoilers to some people, but there's an ability where you can smash down into the floor, and those combo nicely together if you have them on the same icon. And I've just got a lovely combo going now where I basically use Garuda and another icon to take all the stun meter bar down, and then I have my damage ones on another icon, and it's just, I just loved working that out so much.
I think by like end game and like towards the end of the game and for post game stuff, I'd got this sort of layout of six abilities, and one of them would be my massive stun one of them would be my massive damage one, and then four of them would be ones that I rotate, which are like quick hits or, you know, pulling people closer. And then also there's the it's not passive, but there's the extra ability on the circle button for like what you can do, and some and they have such different effects, and sometimes some of them are not like suited to my playstyle, so I would but I want those abilities, so I would pull those master those abilities and then pull them onto another icon as well. And like for example, the Phoenix ability is like the, you know, the quick dash towards your opponent. It's like easily for me the most useful one, and I always made sure I had that available. But then like Shiva's one was really useful as well, and you know, it's interesting, like you've got all these things to experiment to build your perfect loadout, basically. And I think they've done an excellent job there.
I think they did such a good job of making each one of the icons kind of sets feel very distinct. Like they're clearly built around the legacy of these characters. You know, each of their... To give kind of a basic, you have kind of three core abilities that you can kind of choose from, but then they have what I guess you call their ultimate version of what they can do, which is sort of based on the big attack that they've done in previous Final Fantasy. So, for example, Shiva's is Diamond Dust. And like being able to work around, like I'd always let myself have one of those. Like it was like, out of my three icons, one of them's going to get their big one. So choosing kind of that, but also they're not just big, they do a lot of damage instantly. Each one of those is so different. Phoenix's, as you'd guess, like has a health regeneration property to it because Phoenix rising from the ashes, but others have completely different variations. Some of them are very like big single target damage. Others are about like wiping clean a shitload of enemies. And the fact that each one of them felt so kind of thematically correct to the legacy of those summons, and also provided very different gameplay techniques, I think it's a really strong combat suite they've built there.
I mean, so, Diamond Dust, what you just mentioned, is my stun move. I use that as my massive stun move.
I'm using that all the time.
And then I'm a big fan and supporter of Giga Flare as well. It's like my massive attack move, because it also gives you about 5 seconds where you can just relax in the middle of a battle.
I feel like we're running similar things here. I have each of my three have their ultimate unlocked, so I'm running, but I also use the accessories that really reduces the cooldown on some of those as well. I'm just, there is actually, you know, I feel like this is like a very good action game, I think we'll talk about it later. It's not necessarily a great RPG, which is what you'd maybe come to expect from the Final Fantasy series, but There are elements like that where you're juggling the accessories and the abilities where it does feel most like an RPG, I think. Yeah. And it doesn't have quite the, you know, you don't have a whole party, but you kind of do have a party within you a little bit.
Yeah,
but like,
I think I've said on a previous podcast before that the switching between the icons is the closest this gets to, in Final Fantasy VII Remake, the switching between the party members, because obviously Barret is long range, Tifa is kind of like close, quick hits. And you can kind of build that a little bit into your icons, right? You can say like, oh, Ramu, because he's the one that can summon lightning and his special move is firing orbs of lightning. If I need to be at range, I can swap to him and be quite effective. But if I really want to be up close, you know, kind of like the more kind of big fisty kind of icons are much more appropriate for that.
Yeah.
So I think there's a little bit of the party in it. It does put party members in with you. They're mostly there for decoration rather than actually being useful kind of side characters.
It definitely leads to, like, I'm not going to talk about it right now because we're talking about nice things, but it definitely leads to one of my complaints about the party aspect of it. But I suppose Torgal is essentially a second party member. Like, you control him to a certain degree. We're talking about nice things. We'll get back to this.
Well, let's stick to icons. I think the standout things in this game are the massive battles, whether they're against smaller bosses or the massive icons. And we've spoken about it before. The scale of spectacle to these fights are, I think at this point, I will say, unlike anything I've seen in a game. Like, normally the benchmark for me was like, you know, the scale of Shadow of the Colossus or like early God of War. But I think like this just blows those out of the water sometimes. And I know you guys think sometimes maybe they go on a little too long. I think I can't personally get enough of them. And I would play them for an hour straight if I could.
I definitely think they're, in a positive sense, they're amazing highs to the game that I would always look forward to, because it's always telegraphed like who you're going to be coming up with, because you're targeted to a region and you know who the dominant in that region is. So you always know, okay, I'm probably going to have a battle with Titan at some point coming up soon. And the excitement building up to that, and then the reveal of how that battle is going to take place.
The music in that one in particular, fantastic.
Whoa, I disagree there. But like, huge, like, spectacles that you could like build towards. And it felt like a payoff to a chapter, even though they're not called chapters, they always feel like a payoff to a chapter, like this huge spectacle at the end. And I'm massively into that idea of, you know, of that pacing structure. I don't necessarily think they did it that well, but like, I like the idea of it.
It is definitely structured like chapter-wise. Like, I'm sure we'll mention it later. Very influenced by Game of Thrones, and it does almost feel like seasons of a show at times, but not as quite as clearly.
Well, seasons with end bosses, doesn't it? So more video gamey,
but in a way, I think just the fights. And do you know what? Fair play as well. Like, this game has been like completely bug free for me. No crap. Like, the way the amount of going on screen as well, and for no like stutter at all. Like, I'm playing this in performance mode. It's been like smooth as like anything.
The final third of the game for me, there was massive frame drops, like quite a lot. Sometimes I had to reload the game to make it settle a bit.
Mine's been lovely, but that leads me on to the music as well. I think the music in this one, the main battle theme as well, where it like goes from like quite actiony music, I suppose, to then the actual like string segments. It's just beautiful. Like, the music in this game has blown me away as well. Like, just the presentation of this game. Well, sure, we talk about story. I think that it's a very strong story. It's kept me engaged. I don't 100%, you know, it's gone in a direction I didn't necessarily want it to, but I'm still enjoying it.
It's very much a Final Fantasy story. I kind of see this as almost a Final Fantasy that's trying in both ways to look to the future as well as it looks to the past. And in terms of its looking to the past, it goes obviously for almost like, it obviously has a lot of this gritty kind of Game of Thrones influence kind of visual palette to it, and does use an awful lot of salty language, and there's nudity and stuff like that.
There's a lot of swearing.
But it going back, it going back to the sort of like medieval fantasy of the early ones, very heavy crystal kind of like mythology elements to it. All of that feels like it's looking very back towards the original series, and the way that that storyline gives way for the more kind of supernatural things as it progresses into its finale. I do think it's kind of like a hat tip to those earliest days of Final Fantasy, whilst the actual combat and what you do sort of things is looking more towards a future for itself.
Definitely agree. Like, and even like, I'm not massively au fait with the earlier Final Fantasies, but it reminded me in terms of story structure of Final Fantasy IX in quite mm-hmm. a lot of respects.
Yeah, how, and 12, that kind yeah. of...
How it just empires. Sort of, you know, we've got this medieval world that we're building around, and it's all about conflict between the, you know, all the regions and mm-hmm. all the planets, but then the second half of the game, or maybe the final third of the game, takes it into weirder territory where it just yeah. almost forgets all that stuff that's gone before mm-hmm. and it's mainly focused on this. And like, yeah, Final Fantasy IX is probably even like,
yeah.
if you haven't played it, it's bizarrer than this one is. But yeah, there's definitely a lot of that. Like, something I do want to talk about positively is the characters mm-hmm. because I think there's a lot of duff characters, but I think the main like three or four, I think,
I do
like
think some Claire of their strongest ones. Very good.
Yeah, I think it's some of their strongest characters in yeah. a long time, to be honest. Probably since 10, maybe mm-hmm. for me. Like, I think like, can you on like, the characters in Final Fantasy 15? They might as well all be the same person. Just so boring and dull. Whereas I think genuinely Clive is like a fun guy to sort of support and root for. I mean. There's a feature coming out soon next week about his comparison to Game of Thrones. He is basically Jon Snow, but also I love Jon Snow as well. Yeah. I think it's a really good character mm-hmm. idea and yeah. someone you
I think
can root for.
His and Jill's relationship is quite good throughout.
I think it sucks.
Do you not?
Yeah.
No, really?
I disagree
yeah.
with that.
I quite like Jill.
Yeah, we'll leave it for later, but I don't think Jill is a very good character. I think this character does much better by it. Sorry, this game does much better by its male characters.
Yeah.
I think Clive and Cid are really strong.
I think Dion's, I mean, really you won't meet her for well. A while if you don't start the game. But this character called Mid. I love Mid. Do you not like Mid?
I fucking hate Mid. Are you serious? What? You like Mid's, her?
I like Mid.
She was fun. Like really put me off the game for a long period.
Really? Oh, I think she's fun.
She's just but like I think Dion is a really good character, and I think his story arc is really good, and he's one of the main reasons that I am disappointed that this game is not a traditional Final Fantasy party system, because I would like him to be in my party. He feels like a traditional Final Fantasy character that you would have in mm-hmm. your party and play as. Yeah. And
Dion is very good. I do like that side of the story a lot. We're not going to spoil anything, but there's other characters that I think are really interesting.
And I think in terms of kind of like where those characters lead, like obviously a big part of this story is the idea that there are multiple kind of warring kingdoms. And each one has this thing called a dominant, which is their nuclear deterrent, basically. Mm. And I think the way that it kind of deals with how each of these kingdoms, you know, it's the intersection between story and lore, right? And I think the way that each of those dominants is treated in each of their regions is really interesting. And I think they do a good job of, whether it's on a shallow form, which, you know, kind of, I'd say kind of... The dominant that's Hugo Kupka, who can turn into Titan, I think his story is less compelling, mm-hmm. much more drawn in tropes.
Yes.
But I think kind of like...
He's just a bit of a meathead, potato face man, isn't he?
Yeah, but whereas kind of like, I think the way that kind of it treats Dion as a dominant for the Holy Emperor, mm. Empire of Sembrak, I think he's got a lot more going on to him because he's more forward-centric in the yeah. story. But even the ones that are drawn in more kind of broad strokes... I think show you really interesting things about these kingdoms. So the way that they treat the concept yeah. of massive monsters being their main kind of like war deterrent, and what their approach to magic is and all of that supernatural. I think it does this really well. And yes, as we'll come to, there's a lot of Game of Thrones comparisons here, but I think it takes that influence and creates one of the more compelling kind of like settings for a Final Fantasy game. I spent there's in this game, you can go to two characters. One is like the Keeper of Lore, who has all of these like books, basically, that you can read synopsis versions of. And then there's a woman called Valerie,
Vivian?
Is it? Vivian, yeah.
Vivian.
Who, she is kind of like the history scholar. And she has like a table that you can go to that has a map of the world and a timeline at the bottom. And you can scrub through that timeline for every year and every month in the year that this game has events that take place in, and being able to watch kind of like all of these characters move across this map and see like the movements of armies and stuff like that. I thought all of that was super compelling, because that was a thing that I loved about Game of Thrones, just reading the histories. It's a thing that I love about like a lot of other things I'm into. I love knowing the historical perspective on those worlds. And so I think in terms of creating an immersive world that genuinely feels like it has history and place and meaning. I think it's one of the more successful Final Fantasies.
Definitely agree with that. And I think it does an excellent job of mirroring Game of Thrones in that idea when you first start with the book or the show, you don't really know who everybody is. You're kind of just taking it at face value. And it's, I found it with this game and with Game of Thrones, it's only when you're substantially way through that you go back and you see things and you understand it a little bit more. And this has an excellent device. Like you said before, major missions, you'll get called to go speak to Vivian and she'll give you like a state of the world. Like who's where, who's what, who wants to do what. And at any time, obviously, you can pause it and look through this. What do they call the system? Active
time law.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. One of the best features in a game that I've seen in a long time that all games that are heavy and dense the story should have. I think the ability to pause and just say, wait, what is this about? And then instead of having to go to Wikipedia and type it in or something, you can just see it right in the game. Mm-hmm. Fantastic. Yeah.
I think people will, like, who haven't played this game will be kind of going, oh, it's just, you've seen a fantasy thing and you're going, oh, it's like Game of Thrones. But in my preview, I even wrote, like, these are, well, you know, these are tired references at these points. Just go, oh, it's like Game of Thrones. This game really, and we'll keep saying, we'll get on to this. They really are. They've watched Game of Thrones.
I mean, like, they've said it as well. Yeah. Like, it's not like they've tried to hide it.
I wouldn't say they haven't won someone, but they've just taken quite a lot of the tropes.
It's not the same story, but no. The way I've described it to my partner when she was asking what it is if Game of Thrones is like a really fucking good hamburger, then Final Fantasy 16 is the Philly cheesesteak. Like, it has a lot of the same ingredients, but they're kind of remixed in a different form.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So
I do like a Philly cheesesteak.
Yeah, yeah. But that's the thing, right? They're two good dishes.
Yeah,
but I think you can tell a lot of what is in Final Fantasy 16. It's not just influenced. There is a lot of the same ingredients the point where there were several times where I kind of rolled my eyes a little bit. It's like, could you not have been inspired by that rather than taking it just putting a different costume on it?
We can let's segue on to some of the things we don't like as much. Like, I do, like I said, I think this is like a fantastic action game. And like, if you did take out about 10 hours of fetch quests, I think there's like a really brilliant action game.
Well, I think this should have been 20. I think this should have been a 20-25 hour action game rather than, and I know, Dale, that you only played about 30 hours of it to finish it, which suggests that it can be closer to that. But I think it is not RPG enough to support the concept of like this ultimately 70 hour RPG that it can be.
Yeah.
It should have been a much tighter action game.
That's
basically,
that's the problem. Like, when it is just a Devil May Cry of a really compelling story, I think it's brilliant. And when it's trying to be an RPG is actually where it falls down. So we can talk about that. Like, should we talk about the amount of times you just asked to go fetch like nuts from a market or something?
And it's not even like, oh, teach somebody how to do side quests. Like, cause the opening side quest is like practically is very insulting, but it's 2/3 into the game and there's still somebody's like, can you go collect this for me? And you're like, I'm your boss. Like, can't we someone else do this? This is ridiculous.
There's a bit at, I think it was 65, between 65 and 70% of the way through the main quest, where you are asked to go and get some sand, where you go to a beach and all there is five sparkling locations on the sand that you just go up and hold down X and you pick up sand that is not even obviously different to any other sand on the beach, and then you just take that back, and that's a main quest. This is not a side quest. That's a main quest. It then asks you to go to the market and buy garlic and nuts. It's like, why am I doing this?
That is a bizarre. I don't know why they've added those lulls. I don't know if they felt the need to pad it out.
That's the thing.
Like, just cut that out and you make it better.
So I said earlier about the pacing. I think the idea of pacing is great, but the execution is terrible because they've plotted out on paper. We're like, okay, we've got dominant battle, icon battle. In between, we need to slow down the pace and we need peaks and troughs. But the peaks are so high and the troughs are so low. And you come off a huge spectacle where you fought in a dominant, and then it's like, then you've got to do fetch quests for an hour afterwards.
Yeah. My favorite is like, I think it's only like, it's probably like 5 or 6 hours in the story where you have to help basically someone fix a bridge that you could easily just jump across.
Yeah.
Oh, I measured it. So the gap in the bridge, once they'd fixed it and I was able to then push the Phoenix launch button to send across, it was exactly the length of Clive's standard Phoenix like dodge button.
Yeah.
Good. Well, maybe the rest of the party couldn't get across. Maybe Torgal can definitely make the jump.
I would say as well, with all these like side quests, the quest givers usually are just not very good characters and not compelling in the slightest as well. Mm-hmm. Like, there's a character, I think it's early enough on, called Martha, who like dishes out a lot of quests. She's just like, just dull.
Yeah. The thing is, like, is
they kind of tease something interesting going on in that place, but as far as I know, it never fully goes through with it.
There is side quests per like region that sort of wrap up the regions, like you solve all their problems. But honestly, at that point, I kind of checked out the side quests and I was skipping a lot of the dialogue of them because I just thought it was dull.
There's a feeling that they've looked at games, whether they've looked at The Witcher 3 or they've looked at games similar to what CD Projekt have made in that region, where they're like, okay, every side quest character has to have a narrative because it's that narrative that makes the more basic execution that you're going to ask them to do, makes it compelling for the player. But all of the characters have got so much to say, but actually there's next to none of it that's actually interesting, or so much of it is trapped in trope to such an extent that it just feels like that you're playing a fantasy RPG from 25 years ago, well, more than that, because I'd say that I think Final Fantasy VII has much more compelling side characters.
I think the thankful thing is, like, you don't actually have to do any or many of the side quests. The only ones I'd recommend are the ones that have little pluses on them,
definitely,
where they actually increase like how many potions you can hold or something like that. But because you don't, and this is something I'm actually thankful for, because it's where I normally check out of Final Fantasy games, is there's no need to grind at all in this game, because it never really, there's bits that are kind of challenging, some of the boss fights, but like never are you really in trouble, I'd say, and like you don't need to grind. And that's normally, I got like 75% into Final Fantasy X. I was like, I know I'm now going to have to do about 4 hours of grinding to beat this boss. And I was like, I don't have time for this.
I definitely if you do side quests, though, like I was doing quite a lot as I went, it makes the game very easy. Like, I didn't have any challenge whatsoever with that game. And because I felt like I was always about 3 or 4 levels over what I probably should be, it doesn't recommend you levels, but I could always tell when I was like steamrolling people, I was like, I think I'm probably a bit over leveled for this. So if anything, it's more generous the other way, I'd say.
The other thing that it does is, because it's much more of an action game than an RPG, there's no need to have like there's no potion economy. So they've done a Dark Souls style system, which is where you always have a bag with a bunch of potions and high potions in it. And essentially, you can go out and buy potions to refill it, but if you just die and reload the checkpoint, it will automatically refill that bag again.
I'm not trying to show off it. I've literally not died.
Yeah.
Like,
I didn't know that for a long time until I died, but when I saw that, I thought, oh, they really want me to get through this story. Yeah. You know, that's what it feels like.
So I remember kind of like there's a bit fairly early on in Final Fantasy IX where the party splits and you end up having to take a party that doesn't have a healer into quite a tough dungeon. And I can remember having to grind a lot, not to increase the stats of my party, but to get enough money to be able to buy enough potions to get through that boss. Yeah. You're never going to have this problem in this game because a lot of bosses have mid-boss checkpoints so that you can start midway through the fight. And B, every time you're just going to have a refill on all your potions. So there's never any need to be like, oh, I've got to have 99 potions to go in against the last boss. You can only ever take a very limited amount of potions in it. And they'll always get refilled for you. So it's a very different way of approaching party health management.
Well, let's talk.
I would say, though, there's one situation where that doesn't apply, which is the hunts. So there's like 32 hunts that you can do in the game.
Sure.
And most of them are a cakewalk, but there's a few S-tier ones that a little bit tricky, like took a few goes. And when you die for them, you don't respawn in the battle. You respawn at the nearest obelisk, which is like a sort of checkpoint. They're the ones where you do want to go and stock up on potions and stuff beforehand.
Let's just go back to the pikes. I know there are some characters we're not as keen on, maybe, but obviously we're not spoiling. We're trying our best here to not spoil anything. I want to clarify what I think about Jill. I want to say that I like her character and I like her voice performance a lot, but I do agree the story doesn't necessarily do her justice, because the point I'm at anyway, she's not... sidelines maybe the wrong word, but kind of just she's almost a charming MacGuffin.
I was just about to say that I think Final Fantasy historically has had like a very good track record with writing quite compelling women characters, and particularly through the PlayStation 1 era, kind of like Tifa and Aerith are beloved by this community.
I like Lightning.
Okay. I mean, you can like Lightning if you want. But then kind of like, you know, there are characters in Final Fantasy VIII and Final Fantasy IX, particularly with Dagger. Dagger is a really interesting kind of female character. And I think as of late, that Final Fantasy has kind of forgotten its legacy in regards to really good women characters. I think that comes in with Jill. Jill just feels like she's there to be quiet and support Clive.
Yeah.
And I think kind of like that's a, that, I just think it's bad character design. I think there's some really sweet things about her. And there are, it's not that I hated her and was sat in there thinking what an injustice. But I think when I consider how high Final Fantasy has been with supporting characters of both genders, you know, of all genders, I thought she was just a quite a weak character that didn't really feel there to actually have a true, genuine arc of her own.
Yeah,
I have definitely I've liked all the villains I've come across. I will say that, like, they've all had, I think, something different to offer.
I think in terms of like presentation, yes, but they are very like silly sometimes. Like Benedicta is someone we've seen in all the press material, and I do think she's very mustache twirling villain, like evil cackle sort of.
I think
like,
I'm more relating to the kind of the Dion side of things and what happens with that whole
I think Dion
story
is fantastic. He's like literally my second favorite character in this game. But with back to Jill, I will say it definitely felt like, yeah, she was just a party member that needed to be included because Clive needed someone to chat to. Mm-hmm. And it never felt like they have an attempt of her side story, which is kind of like brushed aside very quickly.
Yeah.
But I never felt, I try not to spoil it, but I never felt there was anything with conflict with her with Clive and our other characters. I feel like in any great story you need to have, if you've got if it's a story about multiple people, there needs to be conflict between them and they need to resolve their issues at some point. And then at any point she was just completely willing to go along with whatever Clive wants to do.
Maybe I'm just clouded by the fact she's played by Susanna Wilding from
and that's mad, right?
Okay. Maybe that's just me in my head going, I want to love this character.
And make no mistake, she does have there is an arc built into her. I just think it feels kind of shallow and without the impact of what Clive gets, you know, kind of Clive and Sid gets like an interesting
arc. I know
what
you mean. Like, you're almost made to believe she's billed as almost like secondly, but whereas in fact there's probably 10 other characters that have more interesting things.
You just don't believe that she has her own independent thoughts. I just think she just, whatever Clive says, I'll do and I agree with. But she never feels like she's making her own decisions apart from that one small little section.
We've kind of talked about it a lot. Do you also want to talk about, without spoiling, of course, some of the more blatant Game of Thrones things going on?
We said Clive is Jon Snow, and there's like so many comparisons with that. Honestly, some of them are spoilery. And also, I will say, on Monday, I believe we're putting out a video and an article about all the comparisons that we found, and there is a lot of them. So once you've, perhaps if you don't care, or when you finish the game, check those out.
I mean, even just like, what, the three main like regions in the game? They're pretty much the three main regions from Game of Thrones.
Well, here's one I can say, I feel like, and it doesn't spoil it. There is a section called the Iron Kingdom, which is on the west of the map, and it houses people that call themselves the Iron Blood, which sounds very much like the Iron Islands, which has the Ironborn in them. And it's just like, there's lots of things like that that are just really close and just really too much on the nose. There's a lot of things in there, I think, I can absolutely see that because the whole team was tasked with watching all of Game of Thrones. I can actually see subconsciously bleeding through that they maybe didn't intend it to be a Game of Thrones ripoff. It just happened because it was so programmed in their brain. But they're like the entire Rossville family, like just like the Starks, basically there's lots of similarities with the Starks going on.
Like I said, there's some things we can't spoil, like some villains that are just, they just look like villain, like, we can talk about this later.
It's crazy. Like there is two examples in my head that I won't say, but they are just like, that is just an exact copy of something, of a storyline bit. Like that is just so flagrant. Like, how did you not think that was a ripoff?
Yeah. And I know that like wolves and dogs are like very commonplace in like fantasy and medieval fantasy, but like, Torgal is just ghost.
His backstory is ghost.
That's one of the things I was alluding to. His backstory is ghost. Like, the exact same. It's crazy.
But, yeah. We won't... Like, maybe... I don't know if we'll ever have a spoiler chat about this game, but if we do, we can properly properly go into.
I'd like to do a spoiler chat, to be honest, because I think there's some interesting ideas and things going on in the final third of the game, but also not without flaws and things to
pull apart. Maybe in a week or two, you know.
I quite like the way that this story wraps up. Like, I think it's got some really interesting in its more grander, properly fantasy stuff. Yeah. I think it does some interesting stuff with like its villain's motivation and all of that. Mm. Like, and I think it's for a Final Fantasy game that does go, you know, really quite somewhere. It feels like it properly wraps up and it's got a hold of what it's doing. What I will say is that I think that means that it has to give way a lot of the more interesting Game of Thrones-isms. Mm. Like all the stuff to do with global conflict and the problems between each of the different houses and the more kind of interpersonal relationships do have to give way for this much more fantastical storyline. And I think that's a shame. I think it tries to do stuff with concepts that are a little bit more closer to home that ultimately it can't ever wrap up because...
It's kind of like the opposite of Game of Thrones. Like, you know, obviously the final season is much divisive and stuff, mm-hmm. but ultimately they were always hinting to this huge like supernatural thing, but that wasn't the final problem to solve, mm-hmm. you know?
Yeah.
Whereas this kind of feels like it's flipped on its head a little bit.
Yeah. I'm really enjoying this game. I really am. And like, I think it's mainly, maybe part of it's down to whether you can, I'm not talking about you guys, but in general, people can. I think for me, the highs are so high that I let myself forget about those low points enough. Sure. Like the story highs and those battles and the combat, like to me, are enough to elevate it above the lulls for me. It has enough of that to carry it. But I also can see where there are long stretches where I was definitely thinking, and people could be like, if you only have like 2 hours or an hour to play in the evening and all you're doing is an hour of those fetch quests, you might be like, what am I doing here?
I will say the, I mean, there's an optimal way to play this game, right? And it's to pretty much avoid most of the side quests and just do the ones with the plus symbols on. But mm-hmm. I was playing it like comprehensively because I was playing it to cover it for work. And the amount, at one point I was tempted to time how much time I spend in a section just running around the base, between the people. Hideaway, running between people because you've got, go talk to this one, now go talk to this one, now go to the... And I was like, so much of just travel in between them. And I think the game does a really good job of travel in the world, like getting around in the world. I think it makes it so easy to nip around the world and get where you want. But in the hideaway, it just it's such a slog.
I will say, it took me, I probably went a few more hours than I should have without knowing you can ride a chocobo. So I won't say that.
Oh, shit. Yeah, no,
you see that in trailer, like, that's a good tip to people. Yeah. If you see a plus symbol in Martha's Rest, do that as soon as you can, because that will help.
I would also say there's a lot of areas you can see on maps where there's a slow fade off and you can see, oh, I've got to reveal some of the map there. 90% of the time, they're tied to like side quests or hunts, which most of the hunts don't become available till right near the end of the game anyway. So I'd say don't worry about it too much because there's usually not much down there until you're tasked to go down there.
Yeah. I mean, the actual level, I think the level design is quite poor in a lot of the instances on here. And part of that is because it likes to have the illusion of having, it's not open world, but it has these much larger maps that are designed to be run around. There's nothing in them to do. They might as well, realistically, what they are big flat environments with some texture over the top of it to make it feel like you're going through fairly generic fantasy landscapes. I actually think this game is much better when it's really got a chain around your neck and it's forcing you to go down its main paths. And even then, I've got some slight grievances with the fact that quite often that is cutscene, walk down straight area, fight some things mm-hmm. into cutscene. And in that way, I do feel that after Final Fantasy 15, which obviously is largely considered a bit of kind of like a low point, it feels like they'd fucked up an open world. And so to compensate, they massively reversed on what their like actual concentrated design system was. And ended up in Final Fantasy 13, which I don't think is the place to end, unfortunately.
It feels like they definitely, they ended up, like the first, I don't know, 5 hours of the game is Final Fantasy 13 in terms of how maps work. Like, It definitely feels like they got to the bigger areas, what Final Fantasy 13 has in the like final third of the game, a lot quicker. However, I still felt it took too long. And there were several times where it'd invite me to look at the map, and I'd look at the map and I was like, this is just a straight line. Like, it takes too long to get to the big open sections, I think.
And anyway, I think it doesn't use those big open sections very well. It feels like it's stuck in a bit of a weird kind of position for it. And there is a lot about this game that I think is really good, but that's primarily story and character and combat based. And in many ways, kind of like, I enjoyed this almost as a television show where I could fight the enemies in it more than I did actually as an RPG.
Yeah. Well, anyway, there we go. That's a good chunk of Final Fantasy 16. I'm sure we'll talk about this game again, but as usual, our job to bring a game that's probably sitting around a 90 on Metacritic down to a 75 if you just listen to this podcast.
Well, what do you reckon? I totally want to do a spoiler cast, by the way. So maybe not a whole episode, but just like...
Yeah, we can do
section.
A little post chat in a week or two on or whatever. We can do that. But yeah, hopefully I'll be finishing it tonight so I can talk all about it to you guys, but not to the people listening. Secret Invasion, Matt. That's the new Marvel show. I haven't watched it yet. I will do. Only you've watched it so far out of the three of us, but you've seen the first two episodes. Because you're a greedy little boy, aren't you?
Greedy? Is that what doing my job is?
No. Let me see them both. What do you think of Secret Invasion? Is it... I had hopes that this could be not a restart, because I'm steadily falling out of love with the MCU now, but I felt like this would be one maybe I could get back into if it had that sort of Winter Soldier vibes going on.
As a podcast network, our first priority has always been audio and the stories we're able to share with you. But we also sell merch, and organizing that was made both possible and easy with Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell and grow at every stage of your business, from the launch your online shop stage all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. They have an all-in-one e-commerce platform and in-person POS system, so wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. With the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms, Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers. Shopify has allowed us to share something tangible with the podcast community we've built here, selling our beanies, sweatshirts, and mugs to fans of our shows without taking up too much time from all the other work we do to bring you even more great content. And it's not just us. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. Shopify is also the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/realm, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/REALM now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. shopify.com/realm.
Are you thinking about getting into Dungeons & Dragons? Maybe you're looking to expand your horizons as a DM or a player. If that's the case, then it's time for you to check out The Dungeon Cast, the best D&D podcast out there that helps you passively learn all about the game just by listening. Find The Dungeon Cast anywhere you get podcasts or on YouTube.
Does it?
It's definitely got Winter Soldier vibes. It feels very much of a piece with Winter Soldier Civil War and Falcon and the Winter Soldier. And it has quite a lot of Falcon and the Winter Soldier in it, which already is one of those shows which I really liked what it was going for to begin with, and it just fell apart at the end. And so I'm a little bit more cautious Wary. About where yeah. we're going with this one. But essentially, Secret Invasion is the story. Nick Fury is our main character in this one. And basically, It's set in the modern day MCU, but it looks a lot back at the events of Captain Marvel, in which obviously Nick Fury kind of like the discovery in Captain Marvel of the idea that the Skrulls weren't necessarily the bad guys. They were kind of a refugee sort of race looking for somewhere to hide out. And Fury essentially offered them, right, you can come and stay with me on Earth. And if you act as my spies and my kind of intelligence network, I will eventually find you a home. Secret Invasion is the concept of well, those guys have been sat on our planet for, what, 20, 30 years at this point? And Fury's kind of like not really fulfilled his promise on that. He's been too busy dealing with an awful lot of other things. And a fragment of those refugee Skrulls have created the secret invasion, which is they're kind of worming their way into
invasion
politics.
Invasion of the Body Snatchers.
Yeah, very much Invasion of the Body Snatchers is what this is. It's not a lot like the comics. There's no real superheroes in this, so the whole jive is not, oh my God, kind of like Ant-Man is actually a Skrull. It's not really doing that. It's much more of that kind of, it wants to be that Cold War style thriller. But the idea is like, oh my God, could the president of the United States be a Skrull? Who in the government are Skrulls? And kind of like the opening of it kind of deals with the fact that there's kind of like the Skrulls are doing terrorist attacks to kind of try and cause different nations to come into conflict. And they're going to use that conflict as kind of like cover.
I'm a little bit like, doesn't this undo all the work they did in Captain Marvel to set the Skrulls up as not the bad guys?
So it's not all the Skrulls. So there's a kind of interesting triangle that's at the center of it. So what you've got is you've got a character called Gravik, who is the Skrull that is leading this secret invasion. Who so far we know what his deal is, and we've seen a little bit of him in episode 2. But overall, he's quite a one-note kind of steely villain at the moment who has reasons, I guess, for not wanting, you know, he has been stuck on this planet for a very long time and not getting a new home. But then obviously on the other side, you've got Talos, who is, you know, Ben Mendelsohn's kind of character that's been around the MCU for a while now. He's working with Fury, right? He doesn't want this to happen. And it's like, this is reflecting very poorly on my people. In the middle of that, you've got Gaia, who is Emilia Clarke's character, who is Talos's daughter. And she's kind of torn between the two perspectives. It's like, we're fed up. We want a home. We were promised a home and we haven't got it. But she also understands her father's kind of perspective on this. And I think she, you know, I think Emilia Clarke has always been pretty good. Like, I like her in Game of Thrones. I think she's got the potential here. She's quite good in the first episode and then kind of stands as a bit of a bystander in the second one. So I'm still waiting for her to be the person that creates like this emotional layering that will make this feel worthwhile. Because outside of that, I don't actually think it's as exciting as it needs to be. So this is a paranoid thriller without necessarily any of the paranoia, because quite a lot of the main cast are Skrulls. They're already straight up, we know that they're Skrulls. And there's not that many human characters that could turn out to be Skrulls, which is what the comic relies on. The comic relies on the surprise of like, holy shit, you're a Skrull as well. So this one, I think, is just more about like, just dealing with that storyline about the fact that like all of these people that aren't necessarily characters but are world figures could turn out to be Skrulls. And so the storyline really needs to build around that kind of trilogy between kind of Gaia being pulled between the kind of like freedom fighter slash terrorism side of the Skrulls and the more peaceful ones. We're not far enough in for me to know where that's going with that, but I hope that it can build interesting emotion around that. But so far we're not at that. I do think Nick Fury's quite like Samuel L. Jackson's always good, right? Like, and I think he's good as Nick Fury. And this is a Nick Fury that's post, he got snapped out in the blip, right? And so he's dealing with this whole idea of like, fuck, like maybe I'm completely powerless. Mate, what's the point, right? If I can't save, you know, if I'm the supposed to be the first line of defense for humanity along with all of these superheroes I put together, and even I can just be blipped out of existence. So he's struggling with that, which
it's an interesting parallel to the real world MCU, where if Nick Fury can't bring it all back, then who can?
And so I find it interesting that like he's got some depth there, which I hope that they carry on exploring. But at the moment, I don't generally find it truly exciting. I think it's interesting, and it having that Winter Soldier tone is one of my favorite tones in the MCU. It's got straight out of the Russo's playbook in the way that everything looks, is filmed in that very kind of gritty matte look to all the shots, which compared to, you know, your likes of your very CGI heavy, you know, Multiverse of Madness and Guardians and stuff like that, it's got a genuine style that hints to the tone what this is going to do. I think part of my problem is that a lot of this storyline is just Falcon and the Winter Soldier. Like, that was about a group of terrorists that were struggling in the aftermath of the blip, had been displaced by the fact that everybody came home and it meant that they didn't have their home anymore, and were striking back at a government out of anger, right? Like, you knew where they were coming from. And it struggled to kind of really genuinely humanize those characters and create a sympathetic story for them, even though the storyline was on paper sympathetic. I think there are all of these problems that it's going to face that I don't know yet whether it's going to be successful with that.
Well, I think it's only six episodes, and a lot of this sort of a paranoid thriller is in the payoff.
Yeah.
So, like, if it can build and build and then has a good ending, then
it's in the build, though, right? Like, the payoff doesn't get created if the build, and I don't think the build is there in the first two episodes, because what this should be is, it should be John Carpenter's The Thing, right? Like, it should be John Carpenter's The Thing set in parliaments and the Pentagon and all of that, and I'm not getting that. There's no fuck it could be anyone, because so many of them already are.
Yeah. Well, I'd be interested how it develops. I've got, I have to watch the episodes. So
I'm making you review the third one while I go on holiday.
Episode,
well, I will say it's definitely the first two. It's not bad.
Well, you gave it a 7.
Yeah, it's good. Like, I think it's good. Like, it ticks along. It's an interesting show. It's just not exciting or paranoid enough to really go in. I enjoyed it more than I enjoyed Moon Knight. I'm enjoying it more than I enjoyed She-Hulk. I'm enjoying it more than I enjoyed Ms. Marvel. But is that because it's pulling on the sources that I like? Because it's pulling on Winter Soldier?
I think so, probably.
That than anything
And it's
else.
Not all, you know, it's going to be one show that you'd think, at least for the most part, is not reliant on big CGI fights or like a big monster to turn up.
There's not a lot of fighting, to be quite honest. And that's a part of it that I sort of like. I think, you know, one of its best elements is the fact that it brings MI6 into it for the first time. And the MI6 agent is played by Olivia Colman, who is fucking incredible in this. She is, she's really good.
Isn't she?
Because she's basically, what if your mum was a psychotic spy?
like, we've all been there.
there's a bit in the second episode, you know, I won't spoil what it revolves around, but she's involved in a torture sequence. A, the most graphic thing I think I've ever seen in the MCU. But B, there's just a bit where she hands her phone over to another character. And, like, her phone is in that, like, wallet style that every mum I've ever known has got it in.
Yes, my mum's got that, yes.
Yeah. And the way that she presents it, and she's got this very chirpy voice, and she's really into going around and doing some very nasty things to all of these people. And that is the comic, almost, I'd say comic relief side of it, but relief kind of does a, you know, misjudgment on what she is. She is a main character. And I like it that it's just a bit more unhinged than a lot of the traditional comedy characters in
she's
these.
She's a Skrull, isn't she?
I don't think she is. That's my take on it.
That'll be the interesting thing.
She's one of the very few characters that could be a Skrull, I suppose, because she's projected as a human at the start. There's in episode two, there's also some stuff that suggests that it's more about the dramatic irony than the big twists. Like, it presents things that you as an audience know, but the characters don't. And so maybe that's where it builds its tension. And I hope that it does, because Secret Invasion as a concept is cool. And I hope that it does something good with it. But just at the moment, it's just like, yeah, it's okay. Like, it's decent, but it's not what I think it could be.
Yeah. I am actually genuine. I just haven't got around to watching it. I am intrigued to watch it, because I am into that vibe, and I do love a good paranoia thriller. So yeah, I'm gonna watch it. Let's move on to something else. Let's bring back a segment we probably haven't done in nearly a decade. I don't think we've done it since I was even on the podcast.
I don't remember ever doing it.
Yeah, I remember. Like, oh, there we go. Trailer of the week.
Where did you get, like?
I don't know.
Where did that come from? Like,
I don't know. I was just thinking.
That's in the days of, like, when Alex and Kilby and
first started.
Tilly,
maybe. I don't know where it just sprung up back in my head. I think it's mainly because we've been, like, 2 weeks full of trailers and we don't have time to be with them all. So we're just going to pick out either a game or a film or a TV trailer. We just want to briefly mention you should check out for various different reasons, let's say, because they're not always our favourite of the week. We had Nintendo Direct this week. We don't have much time to speak about much of it, but I think the headline, was it the headline? It should be a headline. A new Mario game is always a headline, isn't it? So, Dale, you've gone with Super Mario Brothers Wonder.
Yeah. So, I mean, I'm a sucker for a Mario game anyway. But this one, a nice, like... I mean, it didn't look that exciting at first, I guess, because it's another 2D platformer Mario game. However, that still fills me with excitement. It was the last, like, 10 seconds that changed the game. when we saw Mario getting a power-up that turns him into Elephant Mario. And I was like, hello, what are we doing here? I'm hoping it goes Mario Odyssey style, where there's just, like, insane amounts of animals or things that you can transform into. And it's not just like, oh, it's the new raccoon or something.
You know? Like,
yeah. I'm very excited. Also, coincidentally, my wife never shows much of an interest in games at all. However, I was playing, what was I playing on Switch recently? It would be Zelda. I was playing a lot and she's like, maybe I'd like to play a game on there. And I was like, well, what sort of game would you like to play? And she's like, I don't know, ones like I used to like Crash and Spyro and stuff. And I was like, a Mario game then. This one looks like it could be perfect. Nah, I think
Odyssey.
3D one is too much of a...
Maybe.
Yeah, I think a 2D one's a nice baby step, I think.
Yeah.
So yeah, I'm very excited.
Whatever animal, pick one animal you want.
Giraffe. I want a giraffe.
Octopus. Like being able to just beat back a load of, you know, monsters.
My mind just went straight to pig. I don't know why. Pig.
Gorilla would be good as well. Like you want the animal you to have some sort of special ability that you can only do certain things. Like a gorilla one would be like there's a rock that you need to smash through.
Isn't that just him turning into Donkey Kong?
Yeah, but so what?
That'd be fun. If he just looked like Donkey Kong as well, that would be good. Had a little like
you had the tie and it said M on the tie instead of DK on the tie.
Yeah, that'd be good. My trailer of the week. Much more highbrow. Luca Guadagnino's new film, Challengers, looks very fun. I'm a sucker for a sports drama film, and this is a romantic sports drama comedy, apparently. I didn't see much comedy in the trailer, but I think there might be some. It stars Zendaya, who I will watch in anything. I think she's unbelievable. Also Mike Feist from West Side Story, if anyone watched it. I like him a lot. But yeah, I'm always a sucker for a new Luca film. I like the vibe of the trailer a lot. And yeah. That's good.
Do you think those two have ever been spoken about in the same segment before?
Who, Super Mario and Zendaya? Or?
No, the film and the game.
Oh, right, Mario and Challengers. Not until now, but you know, there's a first time for everything. Check out the trailer for Challengers. Let's get everyone watching a tennis. It's like a tennis three-way love affair film by the look of it. Looks like good fun. Okay. Check it out. Zendaya seems to break a leg in the trailer, so...
The last tennis film I saw was great, King Richard.
I still haven't seen King Richard.
Oh, it's really good.
But you're a huge Will Smith fan, aren't you, in everything he does?
Am I?
Yeah,
I was in the 90s, to be fair. I loved all his films, except for Wild West, obviously. But I loved
you think he's a big hit.
He definitely delivers a big hit every now and again.
Matt, you just couldn't be more pumped for Kraven the Hunter, is that right?
Like, every time the Sony Spider-Verse pumps out a new trailer, it's like, how could they get it so wrong? Like, why are they still at this?
It is a tragically bad-looking film, isn't it?
This is proper kind of, like, turn of the millennium style superhero film creation, isn't it?
We mentioned it. It's like Halle Berry Catwoman level, this looks like. Like, he turns into Kraven... It looks like by being bitten by a lion.
It's not by bitten, it's the blood that drops into it.
Oh, sorry, transfused. Yeah, not bitten. Wow.
I mean, say something about the trailer. I genuinely believe this trailer looks like it's cut by people who think this is a really good trailer because it's like so action heavy, so all like you've definitely seen all the big sequences in this film in this trailer, and they're like, this will really bring people around. And what it just looks like is noise and just not that compelling.
It also just entirely feels like it's been made by someone that's not got a fucking clue who Kraven the Hunter is.
No, it like, doesn't feel like that character at all.
You know when they did the Spider-Man 2 trailer the other week for the game, and that opens with what felt like a really cool, like, modern interpretation of what Kraven is, and that whole idea of, like, learning about the spider in New York, and it's like, I'm gonna go... Because... Fundamentally, Kraven the Hunter is largely interesting because he's one of Spider-Man's nemesis, right?
He's a hunter and he's going after the biggest game he can find, which is Spider-Man. You take that out of the equation, what have you got?
Well, it looks like Rhino's in it.
Christ. But yeah, this whole idea of like Craven being this kind of like central figure where they obviously, like, one of the things about Craven is that he's like obsessed with killing his prey with his own hands. Like, that's his deal. It's like, I'm going to go and I'm going to take it down, you know, myself. He doesn't like using bows and arrows and stuff like that. And he's got like a crossbow in there shooting someone, which feels to me very much like, oh, we're making a proper R-rated superhero film because that's what people want. Mm. So, no, not really. There are some heroes that suit the R rating, which is your Punishers, your Logans and stuff like that. And then there are just a load of ones which are, he's a camp character, he's a man that dresses,
and he's a villain. Like, they seem to be presenting him as some sort of hero,
but he's like an anti-hero in this, isn't it? It's like,
it's just, didn't they learn from Morbius?
Like, Morbius or Venom? Like, I know there are people that love Venom, and I understand the kind of like incredibly daftness about Venom some people are on board with. I am not. This just looks like a continual going down that well and just making, this isn't as like clearly knowingly camp, at least not from the trailer. It thinks that it's badass and cool, but it looks like what people thought badass and cool was in 2003.
Russell Crowe's his dad, so you know.
What the fuck is that accent, man?
You said they didn't learn anything from Morbius. It's like, that was plainly obvious when that film came out, because they re-released it because a meme taking the piss out of it became popular. They don't understand their audience. It's clear.
It's like, they don't understand the audience. They don't understand what the comics that they're adapting.
Yeah.
They're so desperate to make what they own of Spider-Man work on its own. And it's just like, these characters are compelling because they're part of the wider Spider-Man universe, right? In the kind of like, imagine if they, I mean, they are doing it, aren't they? Just a Penguin TV show. But at least that Penguin TV show is anchored in the Batman.
Yeah.
And it's a wider sort of thing. You can't do these characters, because the most interesting thing about them is, how do they deal with Spider-Man and how does Spider-Man deal with them?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. It's their relationship that is the interesting part.
Yeah.
I didn't think we'd be talking that much about Craven, but there we go. Don't go see Craven. Go see Challengers. Unless Craven comes out and it's amazing. Who knows? Who knows? Let's do a very quick end the search, because it's been a few weeks. I've got a little quick one ready. Let's do it.
Inside, it's a UK IGN crew. Yeah, and ones and twos. We got the games gonna play for you. Inside, I got a question for you. Hold tight, the DJ, we're coming through. Yeah, and ones and twos. We got the games gonna play for you. Inside, I got a question for you. Is it in the search?
I'm bringing back a little IMDb game. Little fun little guessing game here. I've got five questions here for you. I just want you to, they're going to be, give me the highest or lowest rated IMDb scoring film for each of these.
Do you know what? I really thought it was going to be that game where you have to guess the four that's on the front of the page, because I've not played that game yet.
Next time you're on, Dale, we'll get you to play it. How about that? I've just got five topics here, loosely related to some things that we've been talking about. Black Mirror is back. We were going to speak about Black Mirror. We'll do that another time, because we've only watched about two between us. But one of them I watched was good. One of them wasn't. But first, I just want you, on IMDb each, just give me what you think is the highest rated Black Mirror episode on IMDb. What do you think has the highest score?
Sanji Napero is my answer.
Whoa! I was going to say Matt can go first anyway.
That is the answer in it, but I'm going to say...
Is it, though? You don't know it is.
Okay, I'm terrible with the names, but Shut Up and Dance is the name, right? That's the name of the episode, is it?
That is indeed. I should load this up. Just give me 2 seconds to load this up.
My reasoning being is San Junipero was the one that really felt like it broke out beyond Black Mirror and was so universally loved.
Mm-hmm. So, San Junipero is an 8.6 and the third highest rated Black Mirror episode. Sorry, what one did you go for again? Shut Up and Dance. That's an 8.4, Dale. I'm afraid it's the seventh highest rated.
There are two highest.
So at two is Hang the DJ at 8.7, which I just think is a poor man's version of
San Junipero. I like Hang the DJ. I think I like it more than a lot of people. But when I say that, it's because I thought most people thought it was the crap version of San Junipero.
And number one, with a huge 9.1, is White Christmas, the John Hamm one. Oh, people love that one.
I was never that bothered by that one.
Yeah, people really love that one. Yeah,
interesting.
But there we go.
Do you think that's because it being like a Christmas special, it maybe had more critical kind of like
I don't know attention? If that's maybe I'm being ignorant or misremembering. I feel like that's the first one that broke into the US because it had John Hamm in it.
Possibly, yeah. And it was still a Channel 4 thing. One. What? It was the last Channel 4 one, I think.
I think so, yeah.
Did like, I've only watched one episode this season, so I can't really comment on the other four.
Mm.
But yeah, like, I wish it was still British. You know, like, I wish... no, but I like...
I know what you mean.
I liked it when it was like there's one episode and the one when he's controlling the cartoon character and he becomes goes mm-hmm. up for elections and stuff. And
that's
it's all
the worst. I think that's the worst episode.
Is it?
The Waldo effect,
I can't remember. But it's all shot in High Wycombe and mm-hmm. it all just feels very familiar to me. And I like it that it's all it's got this British charm.
So
to
I will
it.
Say I've watched the first two episodes. The first one I wasn't that keen on. The second one called Lock Henry is set in Scotland and it's a mainly Scottish cast and. I think that one's really good.
Okay,
and it's
good.
Proper, like, grim, dark.
See, that's the thing.
Black Mirror.
I think the British sense of humour fits in with the griminess. And also, we've got, like, such a rich history of grimy kind of dramas and stories that it feels inherently British.
Yeah,
it's
definitely.
Really good. It's really clever. It kind of plays on the Netflixification of true crime, which is
I fucking like hate the obsession with true crime. So that sounds like it's my
Lock Henry.
My
check
thing.
Out. I've only watched those two, but that one was really good.
I'm gonna watch that one tonight. I think that sounds interesting.
It's only like 50 minutes as well, so. Yeah, check that out. Check out Lock Henry. Anyway, that's 1-0 to who was it?
Matt.
Good, I'm keeping the score. Right, next I want you to give me, you know, Final Fantasy has a character called Clive in it. Who do you know what? Isn't a stupid name at all. It's a good name, and it works in the story. You forget about it quickly. I want you to give me the lowest IMDb Clive Owen film you can think of.
Oh my God.
Ooh. He's got some bad ones, but he's got some good ones, but he's got some bad ones.
I genuinely can only think of the good ones, though. Yeah. That's the problem. I can't think of him being in bad films.
Oh, he's in some.
And the only one I can come to mind, and I thought it was okay, but it's silly, so I can imagine a lot of people hating it, is Shoot 'Em Up.
Shoot 'Em Up. I watched that film so much when I was like 13, 14. Well, I must have been older, actually, 15 when it came out. So I just remember it's got Paul Giamatti.
He's the main villain.
Paul Giamatti, he's the villain. And Clive Owen's just eating carrots the whole
Doesn't
time.
Doesn't he like shoot carrots at one point or something?
I think
like,
he might shoot a carrot. Yeah. Is that how he kills Paul Giamatti?
Maybe.
Spoilers for Shoot 'Em Up. I think he
I
might
watched
shoot
it once
a carrot
before. This is very silly. But,
I think it's got like, I'm not going to go into that film. But okay, what are you going with, Matt? What remember a low scorer.
Yeah, I'm just thinking of War Things Like Children and Men, which obviously is an outstanding film.
Very good.
He might not be in this, but I'm going to take the risk. Was he in Sin City 2?
He is.
Is he?
Sin City 1, isn't he?
He's in Sin City 1, but I couldn't remember
if
he's
in 2.
Because someone has their face changed and it might be Clive Owen's character.
I think it's Clive Owen's character that has his face changed, unfortunately. Are we going to, and we say that's an automatic fail? Or
yeah,
are you
I guess
getting
so, yeah. Because I can't think of anything that would be...
Okay.
For some reason, I've got him like conflated with Colin Farrell in my head. Yeah. So I was just going to things like Phone Booth. No, he's not in that.
I like
Is he in SWAT? No, he's not in SWAT.
He's been in some bad one. Like I don't know what I would have gone for, to be quite honest. But there you go. Well, I mean, Dale wins.
Do
it was
fault.
A 6.6. Shoot 'Em Up's a 6.6. Oh, which is, not terrible. That's 1-1. Okay, let's go on to the third one. Next week there's a new Indiana Jones film coming out starring a Mr. Harrison Ford. Just give me the highest rated Harrison Ford film you think.
Empire Strikes Back.
I mean, you're meant to take turn, but we're just doing shout out now. Who goes first?
Okay, sorry. Who were you getting? Whose turn was
it
actually? First?
I mean, it was Matt's turn.
Okay,
well, but you know,
then
who's to say that Empire Strikes Back is?
I mean,
the top
honestly,
one,
I? When I said it out loud afterwards, I was like, oh, maybe it's not.
I'm gonna say it's Raiders.
Yeah,
I think Raiders is so beloved.
Air Force One.
Okay, Empire Strikes Back is an 8.7. Raiders. 8.4.
Ooh.
How is it not higher?
Because it's not Can that we... good.
What are you talking about?
I would watch Empire Strikes Back over Raiders.
Yeah. Indiana Jones doesn't do anything for me, mate.
I tell you what, Raiders, I'll give you this code. Raiders is better shot. It's a beautifully shot film, and some of the shadow work in it is phenomenal, but Empire is a more compelling story. No,
Raiders is one of the best films ever made. I'm trying to think, is there a way highest rated? I actually thought Blade Runner 2049 might be there. I'm going to quickly search this. Or maybe the original Blade Runner might be there.
The critics review pull from when it first released, or are they like legacy?
I don't think this is IMDb's not critics, is it? It's just people.
Oh, user rating. Okay, right. Because I was going to say, like, when Blade Runner came out, wasn't it like universally not liked?
Took a while, didn't it, for everyone to come around?
To be fair, I think Empire was number one. Then it was Star Wars, Raiders.
Nice.
So there you go. How's The Fugitive only got a 7.8? What are we doing?
That's a good film.
Right, okay, anyway, let's carry on. So that's 2-1 to Dale. Are we just doing your shout out? I'm guessing we're doing your shout.
Matt go next time.
Okay. Secret Invasion is out. I want who you think's the lowest rated MCU show.
Ooh, show. Ooh.
Okay. What If?
Ooh. What If?
I'm gonna say She-Hulk.
Ooh, She-Hulk.
I've said it now.
You've said it now. What If's a 7.4 on IMDb? She-Hulk.
I mean, some of them were a 7.4. Not many of them were.
She-Hulk and who knows? Maybe it was review bombed. Who knows? She-Hulk's a 5.3.
Yeah. So that was my other thought was Miss Marvel.
I didn't enjoy She-Hulk, but I don't think it's that bad.
Yeah.
But there we go. That's 3-1 to Dale. So he has won the game, but there's still time for one more. I don't know about you. I'm still mourning the loss of Succession. Yep. I still quite think about it quite regularly. I might rewatch that last episode again. I just can't get enough. But I just want the highest rated film of anyone that was in Succession that they have been in. Anyone that's in Succession, a film they have been in.
Is it me
first? It is Dale first, yeah.
Okay, The Big Short has Jeremy Strong.
That would have been my answer. Yeah.
I did want to say, actually I won't say it because it might give Matt a hint. Actually, no, I've won anyway. So I was going to say Scott Pilgrim for, what's his face?
Kieran Culkin.
Kieran Culkin, yeah.
If people didn't know, Big Jezza is in The Big Short.
I'm gonna go for something slightly more unusual. I'm going to say Brian Cox in Manhunter.
Oh, interesting. That's a good shout. That's a very good shout. The Big Short. It's only a 7.8.
What?
On is IMDb. It?
That is like a 10 out of 10 film.
So do you know I think I've said this before. The first time I watched this film, I didn't really like it.
What?
I've watched it about 9 times since and I love it. It's like one of my favourite films.
No exaggeration. At least a dozen times I've seen that film. And so much so now when I put it on, the wife is like, are you watching this again? This is ridiculous. It's so good.
7.8. Manhunter, 7.2.
Oh.
It's a good film. It's a good film. I think I spoke about before how bizarre the end credits of that film is. But 4-1 to Dale. Sorry, Matt. You've lost this one.
That's all right.
You'll be back better than ever, I'm sure. Do you know what's back and better than ever? Feedback. IGN_UK feedback@IGN.com. We put out loads of topics. I think like physical game hacks was one of them. The pizza chat keeps rolling in. But first, we've got one that you're going to read out, Matt.
Yeah, this one's from Andrew Priest, who says, "Hi, IGN team. Hope all is well. On the last podcast, there was talk of game hacks, particularly in Gran Turismo, which I totally did too. Reminded me of a glorious game hack going back to the late 1990s. The game in question was back in the day a great game called International Track and Field, which for anyone that doesn't know, who doesn't know the game, was basically the Olympic Games. From memory, it wasn't an easy game at all and a real challenge to win any of the events. That was until the rapid-fire PS1 controllers were invented. And if you don't remember these pads, they basically had a switch on the controller that when switched on would press a button faster than any human digit could possibly achieve. It was an absolute game changer. You should have seen my character at the 100-meter sprint. Had it been real life, he would definitely have been dragged before the IOC anti-doping committee and been appropriately banned from all events and stripped of any previous accolades. Keep up the good work and welcome to Wes.
definitely relate to this.
I played track and field on the NES. And yeah, that when I was like, I don't know, 5 or 6, and that hurt my little fingers. Yeah.
I've got vivid memories of sitting around friends' house and people taking their turns, and they would all be sitting down to play it, but they would stand up because they're trying to smash the buttons so quickly.
Yeah.
Bring back
track and field.
What was the other one like that? Was it California Games or something like that? Oh, I can't remember now. But there was lots of those sort of the games around at that point.
Basically, the whole game was how fast can you mash these two buttons alternately? Like, that was the whole game.
And people think that retro games are so much better than what we have today.
Exactly. Dale, you've got one along. Yeah. I think along a very similar line.
I haven't read it yet. So this is from Matt Spencer. He says, "Hi, Matt here from Sydney. And although I grew up in Essex, I have been an avid... Although I grew up in Essex, I have been an avid gamer since the beginning." I don't know. Okay, anyway.
It's because he's from Sydney, although he grew up in Essex.
Oh, Essex, and have been. Yes, there we go. I just listened to the recent podcast about physical game cheats, and it sparked a memory all the way back to the mid-80s. When I was a young lad, I'd walk up to the local video shop. I must have only been about 10, so this was obviously before any bad people existed and kids could roam free, to play the arcade version of Track and Field. Back in the 80s, CFCs didn't exist yet either, so aerosol cans were all the rage. Being only 10, I could comfortably fit my hand inside the lid of a can of shaving foam and found that it performed a kind of wanking motion, rubbing the lid repeatedly back and forth over the run buttons. I could comfortably achieve a sub 6 second 100 meter dash. What? Okay. It's only now since you've stirred up this memory that I've searched the internet to see if anyone else might have done the same, and I am yet to find any evidence. In fact, the best time I could find was 8.5 seconds, so I could, in fact, be the holder of a 40-year-old world record. I think it's safe to assume so.
There we go. That's going to some lengths to bringing...
Shaving foam.
To bringing shaving foam to the arcade. Two different ways people have hacked track and field there. The ultimate hackable game? Question mark? I don't know. Good stuff. IGN_UK feedback@IGN.com if you've cheated track and field in any way. Not actually in real life, you know, like you put rocket shoes on and ran at your school sports day or something. But, you know, it might have happened. Anyway, shall I just read an email? Yeah. I've got one here from Luke Hudson. He says, "Hello, IGN UK podcast team."
Hello.
Hello. Channeling Luke there. Got feedback relating to last week's film judgments. Here we go. I'm sure much to Cardry's, can't even say my own name. I'm sure much to Cardry's hatred. I don't refer to myself by my surname. I'm sure much to Simon's hatred. I am someone who doesn't really rate Jaws.
Mm-hmm. That's fine.
It's fine. I saw it for the first time a few years ago and didn't enjoy its slow pace. It's not slow. Come on. An invisible monster.
Oh, mate. Come on.
Can appreciate its place in film history as its iconic quotes, characters are parodied and copied in modern films. It's a very good film. I like it a lot. I would say the problem there is
like you didn't see you've seen all the copies before you saw the originator, you know?
Yeah. And
then its power is lost when it doesn't seem new to you. When it came out, it was like revolutionary.
Jaws is just like I'll probably watch it like in the next couple of weeks. It's a summer like vibe for me. It's just that film feels like water. It's hard to say, like, because it's all about the start of the summer holidays, right? It feels like warm and just like, I don't know, it's just like a comfort watch every summer for me. It's not, you know, comforting, but you know, God, I love that film. Anyway, Luke has a question. On to my question related to this. Are there any films or TV series you've seen parts of or either finished without seeing earlier films in the franchise or seeing the earlier films and not seeing the final film? I've been judged poorly for seeing Lord of the Rings 1 and 2, but not the third one. And Harry Potter 1, 2 and 7 Part 2.
That's good, I like that.
Also, seeing the final episode of Breaking Bad seems to get me a lot of dirty looks. I'm assuming that's only ever seeing the final episode of Break, because that would be mad. Love the podcast and have the deepest respect for the sea, much like Graham Souness.
I can see like why he might have jumped, like the Harry Potter thing and the Breaking Bad thing. It might just be to see what the fuss is, like see what the ending was, so he like part of the conversation.
I could get it with Harry Potter.
Yeah.
Just watching the last episode of Breaking Bad, I don't think you.
But it might have
much,
been like, say, for example, when that happened, we had a party and we had like 15 people around watching it. Could have been in one of those situations. Yeah.
Why haven't you finished Lord of the Rings, Luke?
I mean, maybe he doesn't like it. I mean, yeah, that's true. If you don't like it, watching the first two, like watching the first, saying like it's not for me, but everyone says it's great, yeah. So I'll give the second one a go.
I need that extra.
I've got a confession.
Oh no,
I've never seen Godfather Part 3.
Neither have I.
Yeah, but only because I watched them so many years later, and the narrative was 3's not very good, and I watched 1 and 2 and I was like, I don't need to watch 3 then.
Do you know what I need to watch? They re-released the Coda version a couple of years ago, which is meant to be better. I've seen the first two, I don't know, 20 times each, but the third one I don't have much memory of. I have seen it,
yeah,
but yeah,
I mean, it does complete Michael Corleone's like story, right?
Yeah, it's just, I don't, like, for me, the story could easily end with 2.
Yeah.
But yeah.
Okay. I
want to rewatch those now. But yeah, what if I do know, I think it was one of my aunts I once was speaking to, and it was they'd just talk about a good book they'd read. This was years ago. And they'd only read, you can relate to this one, Max. I don't think Dale's read them. They'd only read the Amber Spyglass in the His Dark Materials. They didn't realize it was a trilogy.
How confusing.
They just started
would that
with that. I don't know how you'd. They enjoyed it, apparently. I was like, how did you know anything that was being, like, any in this world was going on here? Like, I'm trying to think. I'm quite weird about these things. I don't jump. I have to do things from the start, or I have to, like, kind of finish things.
There's lots of games. There's tons of examples of you just don't need to play.
No.
Final Fantasy is a very good example. You know?
Yeah, but at least they're not narratively linked, right? They're kind of the quote-unquote anthology.
If you don't know anything about Final Fantasy and you see it on a shelf, you might be put off because it says 16 and it takes you 5 seconds to find that out.
It's different with games, isn't it? Because some just like date badly. Like with Uncharted, like I would say to some people, like Uncharted 4 for me is the best one. And I would say just play 4, but you kind of want to play the trilogy for the impact of 4 to be had. I still think they
hold up pretty well. Like
maybe you could watch a YouTube cutscene compilation of the first one, and then maybe play from 2 onwards.
You're right about the game. Like film as a medium doesn't date as much. You know, it does date. I agree. Like, you know, definitely because the guy mentioned about Jaws earlier and the slow pace of editing, that was definitely a thing. Like editing has got faster and nippier. But with games, like I would never recommend anyone play Metal Gear or Metal Gear 2 and just go straight to Metal Gear Solid, you know? Some people don't even do that, do they? Some people go straight to like Metal Gear 3 or
3.
Yeah.
I mean, that's one I think we spoke about a few weeks ago. Yeah. I've still not properly played Metal Gear 2 and I never finished 4, but I played 1, 3 and 5. But
it's a different vibe of games, though, I guess, isn't it? It's not always just about the story. It's about game mechanics and the fun that you can have playing the game as well.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm.
And then also, if you work this job, you're occasionally forced to jump into things that you wouldn't normally do. So, for example, I have seen only 2 of the Fast and the Furious films. Maybe 3. I think I've seen the first one a very long time ago. Yeah. But because of doing some work around it, 2 years ago, I think I had to watch like whatever the most recent one was. I guess I had no idea what was going on for the most part in terms of those character relationships, but they're so simple that it doesn't matter. But I have no intent to go back and fill in the gaps.
Didn't you watch Hobbs and Shaw as well?
Yeah, but that one felt more detached, I think. Right. Yeah,
I've only ever seen the first one. Honestly, it is on my list of my paternity period to maybe like that and Mission Impossible, 2 series I've never really bothered with.
Mission Impossible is genuinely good though.
I've seen the first 3 and I thought three was really, really good, and I don't know why 3, I never bothered I after 3. That.
So that's an interesting
4 is amazing as well.
Yeah, I basically started watching Mission Impossible from 4. So that's the one that Brad Bird did, right? Where they're on the building.
The Burj Khalifa,
I have seen the first one a lot because it's one of my dad's favourite films. So when I was a kid, I'd seen that one. Mm-hmm. And then just felt no necessarily... I think it was because Brad Bird had done that fourth one and it looked new and shiny that I started from there. And I've never watched 2 or 3.
2's like, from trash. 4 is don't when... bother.
Mm-hmm. 2 is interesting. It's not great. 3 I love, mainly because Philip Seymour Hoffman's just incredible in that film. 4 is like where it's like the modern Mishbob where they're like, we need the key stunt. Everything's centered around this key stunt. And 4, 5 I'm not as keen on, but then 6 is Fallout, right? 6 is amazing. And then, Dead Reckoning.
Which is the one with... Henry Cavill and his
that's
fists.
Fallout. Fallout, okay, right. Six.
So yeah, because obviously they're not numbered. So I sort of, to me, there's been a blur of Mission Impossible films for the last 10 years, and I don't really
they stopped
know what's
after three naming them. Yeah, but oh, I love Mission Impossible so much. Can't wait. 2 weeks away from a new Mission Impossible. That's exciting. Let's do an episode all about stunts or something. Okay, it's been a long podcast, but it's been a fun one. I'm going to go and finish Final Fantasy 16. That's what I'm going to do. Later. I mean, it's the middle of
the moment. I was going to say, you're not going to do some work?
Well, lunch is coming up. I've got an hour's lunch. I can do a bit, you know.
Yeah.
But yeah. What music are we having? It's got to be some Final Fantasy 16 music, hasn't it?
Yeah, like...
The battle theme is pretty great.
Yeah,
I think the one that they do when you fight the summons, where it's got like the operatic kind of thing going on in the background, it's like properly.
It's got that weird major key section though, where it just like really like changes the tone of it every time. And it's like that always throws me off.
That bit.
I don't like that bit, but the rest of it I do like.
I love it.
I also hated the music with the Titan thing because I thought it was stupid.
So, I liked because I was laughing. I was like, yeah, here we go. This is mad. When they go full, let's talk about Final Fantasy again. When it goes bonkers, I'm just into it. Just go full bonkers. Go for it. Anyway, I hope you're enjoying Final Fantasy if you're playing it. And we'll see you next week.
Maybe write in some feedback for when you finished it as well. What you thought of the game. And then if we do a spoiler cast, we can read some of that too.
Maybe subject it spoilers so other people don't open it and read it. Anyway. Good day. Goodbye.
Bye.
Have a lovely time.
Contained herein are the heresies of Radolf Buntwine, erstwhile monk-turned-traveling medical investigator. Join me as I uncover the blasphemous truth of a plague-ridden world, that ours is not a loving God, and we are not its favored children. The heresies of Radolf Buntwine, coming January 2nd, wherever podcasts are available.